And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, today is January 31st. 31st day of the year. 334 days remain till the year's over with. I do want to welcome my Chinese listeners. Almost 10% of my listeners are coming from China. Right in the year 314, Pope Sylvester I is consecrated as successor to the late Pope Miltiades. Gotta consecrate that sucker. 1208, the Battle of Lena takes place between King Sverker II of Sweden and his rival Prince Eric, whose victory puts him on the throne as King Eric X of Sweden. 1504, the Treaty of Lyon ends the Italian War, confirming French domination of northern Italy. Spain gets the Kingdom of Naples. 1578, 80 Years' War and Anglo-Spanish War. The Battle of Gemblau is a victory for the Spanish forces led by Don John of Austria over a rebel army of Dutch, Flemish, English, Scottish, German, French, and Walloons. Year 1606, the Gunpowder Plot. For the conspirators to blow up Parliament and the king, including Guy Fawkes, are executed for treason by hanging, drawing, and quartering for plotting against Parliament and King James. Now, interestingly enough, there's very little said about the fact that the actual design of the plot took place at the manor house of Ashby St. Ledger, which I came within a gnat's eyelash of buying at one point in time. 1747, the first venereal disease clinic opens in London Lock Hospital. 1814, Gervasio Antonio de Posadas becomes Supreme Director of the United Provinces of the Rio de la Plata. That's present-day Argentina. 1846, after the Milwaukee Bridge War, the U.S. towns of Juneau Town and Kilburn Town unified to create the city of Milwaukee. 1848, John C. Fremont is court-martialed for mutiny and disobeying orders. 1862, Alvin Graham Clark discovers the white dwarf star Sirius B, a companion of Sirius. He used an 18.5-inch telescope, now located at Northwestern University. 1865, American Civil War. Congress passes the 13th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. It abolishes slavery and submits it to the states for ratification. Also in 1865, American Civil War, Confederate General Robert E. Lee becomes General-in-Chief of all Confederate armies, what are left at that point in time. 1891, History of Portugal. First attempt at a Portuguese Republican Revolution breaks out in the northern city of Porto. 1900, Datu Muhammad Sela is killed in Kampung Tibo, Tambunan, ending the Mat Sela Rebellion. Now, for those that are not familiar with the Mat Sela Rebellion, it was a series of major arms disturbances against the British North Borneo Chartered Company administration in North Borneo, which is now the Malaysian state of Sabah, instigated by Datu Muhammad Sela, also known as Mat Sela. He was a local chief from the Lingkabu district in Sigut River, led the rebellion between 1894 until his death in Tambunan in 1900. Then the rebellion went on for another 5 years till 1905. Now, his revolts were widely supported by the local communities and affected a large geographical area, some Sandakan across Gaya Island, including the interior, especially Tambunan. His most notable uprising occurred at midnight on July 9, 1897, when he led his followers to successfully attack a major colonial settlement on Gaya Island. You know, the Brits were somewhat heavy-handed in their subjugation of the world. 1901, Anton Chekhov's Three Sisters premieres at Moscow's Theater in Russia. 1915, World War One. Germany's the first to make large-scale use of poison gas in warfare in the Battle of Bolimo against Russia. 1917, World War One. Kaiser Wilhelm II orders the resumption of unrestricted submarine warfare. He'd agreed to restrict it so neutral ships weren't sunk. 1918. A series of accidental collisions on a misty Scottish night leads to the loss of two of all Navy submarines, with over 100 lives, and damage to another 5 British warships. 1918, Finnish Civil War. The Sulanula Massacre, which changes the nature of war in a more hostile direction, takes place in Kangasala. 1919, the Battle of George Square takes place in Glasgow, Scotland, during a campaign for shorter working hours. 1928, Leon Trotsky's exile to Alma Ata. Now, Alma Ata was formerly known as Vernai. It's the largest city in Kazakhstan. Population about 2 million these days. It was the capital of Kazakhstan from 1929 to 1997, when the government relocated the capital to Akmola, renamed Astana in 1998. They just wanted him out of Moscow. They didn't care really where he went. Visnay wound up in Mexico as a reporter, and he was assassinated. 1942, World War II, Allied forces are defeated by the Japanese at the Battle of Malaya and retreat to Singapore. 1943, World War II, German Field Marshal Frederick Paulus surrenders to the Soviets at Stalingrad. 2 days later, the remainder of his 6th Army also surrendered, ending one of the war's fiercest battles. And primarily, they were defeated by the weather, not the Russians. 1944, World War II, American forces land on Kwajalein Atoll and other islands in the Japanese-held Marshall Islands. Also in 44, World War II, during the Anzio Campaign, the 1st Ranger Battalion, also known as Darby's Rangers, is destroyed behind enemy lines in a heavily outnumbered encounter at the Battle of Cisterna in Italy. 1945, U.S. Army Private Eddie Slovic is executed for desertion. That was the first such execution of an American soldier for desertion since the Civil War. 1945, World War II. About 3,000 inmates from the Sutthof concentration camp are forcibly marched into the Baltic Sea at Pamnicken and executed. 1945, World War II, the end of fighting in the Battle of Hill 170 during the Burma Campaign, in which the British 3 Commando Brigade repulsed the Japanese counterattack on their positions and precipitated a general retirement from the Arakan Peninsula. 1946, Cold War. Yugoslavia's new constitution, modeling that of the Soviet Union, establishes 6 constituent republics: Bosnia and Herzegovina, Croatia, Macedonia, Montenegro, Serbia, and Slovenia. Also in 1946, the Democratic Republic of Vietnam introduces the Dong to replace the French Indochinese Piasta at par. 1949, These Are My Children, the first television daytime soap opera, is broadcast by the NBC station in Chicago. 1950, President Truman orders the development of thermonuclear weapons. 1951, United Nations Security Council Resolution 90 relating to the Korean War is adopted and immediately ignored by everybody. 1953, North Sea flood causes over 1,800 deaths in the Netherlands and over 300 in the UK. 1957, 8 people, 5 total crew from 2 aircraft and 3 on the ground in Pacoima, California, are killed following the mid-air collision between a Douglas DC-7 airliner and a Northrop F-89 Scorpion jet fighter. When you're on the ground and get hit by a falling airplane, you know you're having a bad day. 1958, Cold War, Space Race. The first successful American satellite detects the Van Allen radiation belt. We also found the Black Knight, which was a mysterious satellite in polar orbit. Still there, as far as I know. 1961, Project Mercury. Mercury Redstone 2, the chimpanzee Ham, travels into outer space. Upon return to Earth, was immediately elected to Congress. 1966, Soviet Union launches the unmanned Luna 9 spacecraft as part of the Luna program. 1968, Vietnam War. Viet Cong guerrillas attacked the U.S. Embassy in Saigon, and other attacks in the early morning hours later grouped together as the Tet Offensive. 1968, Nauru gains independence from Australia. 1971, Apollo 14. Astronauts Alan Shepard, Stuart Rusa, Edgar Mitchell aboard a Saturn V lift off for a mission to the Fra Mauro Highlands on the moon. 1971, the Winter Soldier investigation organized by the Vietnam Veterans Against the War to publicize war crimes and atrocities by Americans and allies of Vietnam begins in Detroit. Now, the Winter Soldier investigation was basically a media event sponsored by the Vietnam Veterans Against the War. It went from January 31st, 1971 to February 2nd, 1971. The Vietnam Veterans Against the War challenged the morality and conduct of the war by showing a direct relationship between military policies and war crimes. They had 109 veterans at that three-day gathering and 16 civilians. It took place in Detroit. Discharged servicemen from each branch of the armed forces, as well as civilian contractors, medical personnel, and academics, all gave testimony about war crimes they'd committed or witnessed during the years 63 to 70. Now, with the exception of Pacifica Radio, the event wasn't covered extensively outside of Detroit. Several journalists and a film crew recorded the event in a documentary film titled Winter Soldiers, released in 1972. A complete transcript was later entered into the Congressional Record by Senator Mark Hatfield and discussed at the Fulbright hearings in April and May of 71. Basically, they were looking for attention. Now, right now, especially in this congressional district, if you're a disabled veteran and you ask your congresswoman for assistance, if you're not an undocumented immigrant, she's going to turn her back on you. The last time I contacted her office, they never responded officially, but they told me in a phone call that she was too busy with the poor undocumented immigrants to worry about disabled veterans. And this is our elected representative. 1978, the Crown of St. Stephen, also known as the Holy Crown of Hungary, goes on public display after being returned to Hungary from the U.S. It was held in the U.S. after World War II. 1988, Doug Williams becomes the first African-American quarterback to play in a Super Bowl and leads the Washington Redskins to victory in Super Bowl XII. 1996, an explosive-filled truck rams into the gates of the central back of Sri Lankan Colombo, kills at least 86 and injures over 1,400. I don't know that anybody claimed responsibility for the attack. In 2000, Alaska Airlines Flight 261 crashes. An MD-83 experiencing horizontal stabilizer problems crashes into the Pacific Ocean off the coast of Point Magoo in California. There were 88 people on board and they all died. 2001, in the Netherlands, a Scottish court convicts Livian Eldabasset Almagrahi and acquits another Libyan citizen for their part in the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie, Scotland in 1988. 2001, two Japanese airline planes nearly collide over Surugu Bay in Japan. 2009, in Kenya, at least 113 are killed, over 200 injured following an oil spillage ignition in Molo, days after a massive fire at a Nakumat supermarket in Nairobi killed at least 25. Not safe anywhere. 2018, both a blue moon and a total lunar eclipse occur on this same date. 2019, Abdullah of Pahang is sworn in as the 16th Yang di Pertuan Agong of Malaysia. And in 2020, the UK membership with the European Union ceases in accordance with Article 50 after 47 years of being a member state. A lot of births and deaths on this date in history. holidays and observances, Christian Feast Day, Domitius of Amiens, Francis Xavier Bianchi, Jeremianus, John Bosco, Julius of Novara, Blessed Ludovica, Madoc in Mogu and Eden, Marcella, Samuel Shoemaker in the Episcopal Church in the U.S., Tysol, Euphia, Will Gills, Amartihi in Mehrabad in India, followers of Meher Baba. Independence Day in Nauru, celebrates independence from Australia in 1968. And in Austria, it is Street Children's Day. Everybody's got a day. In 1858, the Great Eastern, the five-funnel steamship designed by Brunel, was launched at Millwall. 1876, all Native American Indians were ordered to move into reservations. 1893, the trademark Coca-Cola was first registered in the U.S. Patent Office. 1929, on this day in 29, after the USSR exiled Leon Trotsky, he found his asylum in Mexico. Worked as a reporter, eventually was assassinated. 1930, U.S. Navy Lieutenant Ralph Barnaby became the first glider pilot to have his craft released from a dirigible at Lakehurst, New Jersey. 1934, Jim Lundos defeated Joe Savaldi in a one-fall match in Chicago, Illinois. It was a wrestling match. The crowd of 20,000 was one of the largest crowds ever to see a wrestling match. 1936, the radio show The Green Hornet debuted. 1940, the first Social Security check was issued by the U.S. government. 1958, Explorer 1 was put into orbit around the Earth. It was the first U.S. Earth satellite. 1960, Julie Andrews, Henry Fonda, Rex Harrison, and Jackie Gleason appeared in a two-hour TV special entitled The Fabulous 50s. 1971, telephone service between East and West Berlin are reestablished after 19 years. 1982, Sandy Duncan gave her final performance as Peter Pan in Los Angeles. She completed 956 performances without missing a show. 1983, on this date, the wearing of seatbelts in cars became compulsory in Britain. 1983, J.C. Penney announces plans to spend in excess of $1 billion over the next 5 years to modernize stores and accelerate a repositioning program. 1985, the final Jeep rolled off the assembly line at the AMC plant in Toledo, Ohio. 1990, McDonald's opens its first fast food restaurant in Moscow. 1995, President, you got a great rear end, Clinton, invoked presidential emergency authority to provide a $20 billion loan to Mexico to stabilize its economy. Screw the states. Screw the disabled veterans. We've got to take care of the Mexican state. In 2000, John Rocker, the Atlanta Braves, was suspended from Major League Baseball for disparaging foreigners, homosexuals, and minorities in an interview published in Sports Illustrated. 2005, Keanu Reeves got a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. Let's see if there's anything else. In 2000, Dr. Harold Shipman, a family GP, is jailed for life for murdering 15 of his patients. They also thought he killed more than 100 other patients, but he didn't confess to those. He's now Britain's most prolific convicted serial killer. 1953, major storm with winds in excess of 100 miles per hour caused flooding in three countries with North Sea coastal areas, killing more than 2,000 people in the Netherlands, Great Britain, and Belgium. 1929, Sunday sports were to be permitted in Boston, effective this date in 29. The mayor had to sign an ordinance to allow this because the churches were just up in arms. And they had to buy permits. Atlanta Braves had to pay $2,500 for a permit, which was no chicken feed in those days. The Red Sox, who was playing against them, were required to pay $1,000. And the reason why they were required to pay different amounts was because the difference in renting capacity of the parks each of these two teams would play in. Apparently, the Braves playing field was bigger than the Red Sox playing field. 1942, on this date, the manufacture of civilian vehicles by companies such as Chevrolet or DeSoto was stopped. From this time on until the end of the war, only military vehicles were produced. 1945, main route was created from India to China for the purpose of transporting Allied military troops that opposed Hitler and his army. Path was established via the country of Burma, which provided a link between the two countries. The bridge on the River Kwai was part of that route, and if you remember, there was a book and a movie called The Bridge on the River Kwai. And on this date, 1953, the British Railways Princess Victoria car ferry sunk in the Irish Sea in one of the worst gales in living memory, claimed the lives of more than 130 passengers and crew. In 1961, six Americans were sentenced to prison for 30 years in Cuba. They were serving a sentence after being charged with bringing arms to anti-Castro guerrillas. The Americans that were arrested and tried, pled guilty, said they had stolen a boat to use to defend the Castro Revolution. Field Minister Fidel Castro himself is said to have gotten involved in this case. 1968, 19-man Viet Cong suicide squad seized the U.S. Embassy in Saigon and held it for 6 hours until an assault force of U.S. paratroopers landed by helicopter on the building's roof and took back control. This incident began the Tet Offensive by Viet Cong forces. In 1972, the police hunted for a terrorist robbery suspect, didn't find him. A total of 14 armed terrorists had held up the National Development Bank for over a period of 8 hours on the weekend prior to this hunt. The group that admitted to the terrorist crime described was the Trotskyite People's Revolutionary Army. According to the press, it also documented the Trotskyite Army also confessed to having run off with $450,000 for the purpose of furthering the revolution. The robbery guerrillas also bragged about the fact they stole documents that proved that bourgeois sectors had committed fraud. Well, on that interesting note, we have come to the end of our little history segment. We've been talking about UFOs in our previous shows, and it's always a fascinating topic. Lately, our government has begun to waver from its "it's all in your mind" attitude. Now, we talked about what was called the Ryan event in our last show, where the Air Force ask a civilian pilot to keep track of a UFO. Then later on, of course, everybody denied it, and the captain who had given an interview saying that they had changed his story. Now, a number of groups tried to investigate. And the Civil Aeronautics Administration was requested to release their notes and write up about the report. And they refused. The belief is they ordered the pilot to change the flight log. A Civil Aeronautics Board informant, today to be called a whistleblower, later offered information to the what was called NICAP. According to them, the pilot was in radio contact with Griffith Air Force Base. And he did state that the pilot, even in light of his initial statement, denied pursuing the object. Now, this probably isn't much of a leap to think there's a good possibility of a cover-up of the UFO sightings by pilots, and specifically by the two pilots in this incident. A cover-up that has successfully, at least officially, stood for at least 60 years. Now, had the captain changed his story at the instance of the Air Force? Or was the request the airlines? They don't want passengers to know that they willy-nilly chase UFOs across the sky. That endangers the passengers. They were concerned, of course, about their public image and safety of passengers following the claim one of their pilots had actually chased a UFO. Or did the pilot make it up? But if he did, what'd he have to gain? I mean, put his job at risk. Now, he never denied he saw something bizarre. He denies he gave chase to it. And how about the first officer and the stewardess? Now, most of the publicity has been directed at the pilot, because he was the main guy. In a television interview only 8 days after the incident, the pilot and the co-pilot spoke at length about the incident. And the version given by the co-pilot matched the version given by the pilot. So that we know that they saw something. But what that something was still remains unknown. And we don't know why the pilot eventually changed his story. Now, according to some pilots I talked to while waiting to take a plane myself, there are strange things seen in the skies all the time. And it's gotten to the point that they don't even report them because they don't get a good reception from their employers. Let's go to July 17, 1957. Mississippi. The RB-47 incident. At 4:10 in the morning, about the time of day that the Roswell report says the Mogul balloons used to be released, a strange object was detected by radar flying around a plane when suddenly an intense blue light shone down on the plane and shook the pilot and the co-pilot. Then the object changed course and flew away at an impossible speed. The pilot then saw a huge blue light that appeared to be attached to a larger object concealed in the darkness. There was a suspicion it was a reactor suspended under a balloon. Second object then also appeared on the radar and flew in that same impossible manner, stopping it for an instant, changing directions, and flying off. Never got any explanation as to what this might be. Then we have March 16, 1966. Moro do Ventum, Niterói, Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. In this particular incident, two UFO enthusiasts, Miguel Jose Viana, who was 34, and 32-year-old Manuel Piero de Cruz, were found dead on top of a hill from which UFOs had been sighted previously. They'd gone there hoping to see one for themselves. Their bodies appeared to be pink, possibly burnt, but difficult to tell due to the condition of the bodies. Now, the bodies didn't smell, suggesting maybe the radiation had killed the bacteria would otherwise have started the decomposition process. They had homemade lead masks, and a note found beside one of them said, "Meet at the designated spot at 4:30 p.m. At 6:30 p.m., ingest the capsules. After the effect is produced, protect half the face with lead mask. Wait for the prearranged signal." Well, it was never known what the tablets contained, and of course it's possible that these somehow caused their death. But with the lead mask, the pinkish, possibly burnt appearance, and the lack of odor on the bodies, it may be that they were expecting to come into contact with radiation and had taken some iodine tablets in the hope it would offer some protection. Now, the ensuing autopsy didn't find any poison in their digestive systems. And even 10 years after the event, the ground where the bodies were found was still bare in comparison with the surrounding thick vegetation. And it would also support the idea of radiation exposure. Now, a witness sketched a series of what he called effervescent spheres which flew over the area. They were seen not only by the witness, but also by his wife, his daughter, and his son-in-law. The object flew over the Mono Diboa Viagam in the Teroi. On a police call for investigation, Gracinda Barbosa Cunho de Souza said she was driving on Alameda, Sao Benaventure, and Fonseca. The evening of the death, she and her children saw over the Morro de Ventum Hill an orange oval-shaped object with a line of fire around its edges, sending out rays in all directions. She said it hovered about 100 feet over the hill, giving off a well-defined blue ray. He said she stopped the car to watch the object as it rose and fell vertically for 3 or 4 minutes. Now, this vertical rise and fall matches exactly the description in the Air Force's Roswell report of how the balloon's manager altitude with changes in heat, causing a rise and fall managed by a pressure switch and a ballast system. Now, a large number of witnesses independently called police with their sightings of this orange egg-shaped object giving off blue rays over Morro de Ventum. Many said they hadn't reported it at the time due to the fear of ridicule, which our culture has for some reason attached to UFO witnesses in modern times. All the reports placed the object in the vicinity of the victims near the estimated time of death. Now, a friend of the victims, LCO, told investigators are all part of a spiritualist group interested in UFOs. On June 13, 1966, 2 months before the two men died, they'd tried an experiment on Atafona Beach, where they had witnessed a blinding flash in the sky. Local fishermen reported they saw a flying saucer fall into the sky, and the explosion was powerful enough to be heard 40 kilometers away in Campos. They were curious to experiment again and see if it was possible to see another UFO and maybe make contact with them. So it's interesting to note that their innate human curiosity, which is so important for our survival and the progress as a species, led to the death of these two family men. Well, let's move to the 70s, 80s, and 90s. This first event was September 8, 1973, at Hunter Army Airfield. For those that are not familiar, the Army still has its own air wing, and I have been told that it has more aircraft than the Air Force does. One UFO sighting event didn't come widely publicized, but it was a historically significant incident in the history of UFOs. One or more UFOs were sighted in the early hours of September 8, 1973 at Hunter Army Airfield in Savannah, Georgia. The main witnesses were two military policemen who were patrolling the perimeter of the base, as well as a state trooper. And there was a local citizen who was driving her son who saw a UFO which hovered over the top of her car and illuminated it with bright red light till it flew away. The two military policemen reported they saw an object move slowly across the treetops with strobe light multicolored flashing lights. Then the craft suddenly dove down at the vehicle, causing the men to swerve into the surrounding grass. One of the men initially drew his revolver but didn't fire it. Object moved away and was hovering silently over the runway at an altitude of 10 feet, about 100 feet in circumference and 100 feet across. The object was described as being oval with amber, blue, and mauve flashing lights. Well, the The policeman's communication equipment failed to function after that close contact till the UFO took off, after which everything went back to functioning normally. And that has been reported in many instances. It also shut down the engines. They then got through to the command station, were told to return, report, but the UFO then reappeared over the trees. It followed them for a quarter of a mile as they headed back toward the station. Then the UFO suddenly took off at an incredible speed. When they got back to the station, a desk sergeant told them a state police officer on the highway near the perimeter of the base had also reported seeing that same object. Now, the Hunter Army Airfield sighting is considered important because it set the pattern for future sightings over military installations. Also, uniquely, military personnel involved were allowed to talk publicly about their experiences. Future similar events were hushed up. The contact that I had in South America, I was told if I wanted to remain an officer, keep my mouth shut. And a cover-up ensued. In 1975, University of Bogota in Colombia. Three respected researchers, Enrique Castillo of Venezuela and Carlos and Ricardo Velasquez of Costa Rica, reported in 1985 to Jacques Vallée having obtained a metal fragment of a UFO incident that occurred about 10 years before. Two students were walking on the campus of the University of Bogota one rainy night in 1975 when they heard a strange sound overhead. Looking up through the rain, they saw a disc. Its flight made it clear it was having some difficulty. They estimated its diameter at 4 meters and its altitude at 1,000 meters. And while this first object seemed out of control, they saw four other discs flying to its vicinity as if it was going to assist it. They were about the same size and shape. At that point, according to witnesses, spouts of liquid were ejected from a central disc. Well, the students took refuge under a tree and saw the bright liquid fall into the rainwater puddles in the street, which produced a vapor. Then all five objects rose and disappeared into the low rain clouds. Well, the witnesses immediately went to the rainwater puddles where they had seen the material fall and recovered two metal chunks about 4 inches by 1.5 inches. They had let it cool for about 10 minutes before they could touch it. Analysis later showed it was an aluminum alloy that had been melted through and through and that nothing survived of the initial structure. The description of the UFO and its operation matches closely with that of the consistent altitude balloon system described in the Air Force's Roswell report. What the students thought was an object in difficulty may have been one of the balloons in the balloon train being blown by wind or heat or maybe having been damaged, leading to the balloon train's low altitude. As the remaining balloons move toward the first one, it's all tied together. This could well have been interpreted as the other UFOs approaching the first one to help it. And the bright wick that ejected from the central disc would have been the compass lubricant or aircraft lubricant, which was used as ballast. As soon as the ballast was dropped, the balloon train began to ascend immediately and disappeared. But was it? Let's go to 1976, September 19th to be exact, Tehran, Iran. Now, the 1976 Tehran UFO incident was a radar and visual sighting of an unidentified flying object over Tehran, the capital of Iran. During the early morning hours of September 19th, 1976. During the incident, two Imperial Iranian Air Force F-4 Phantom II jet interceptors reported losing instrumentation and communications as they came close to the object. As soon as they withdrew from proximity, their instrumentation and communications were restored. One of the aircraft also reported a temporary weapon systems failure while the crew was preparing to open fire. Initial reported incident was related to U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, September 19, 1976. The 1976 Tehran UFO incident was a radar and visual sighting that left a major impact on both our military as well as theirs. A couple of F-4 jets from the Iranian Air Force were scrambled to investigate some other sightings of lights in the sky. Now, reports vary about what happened, but at least one jet suffered grave electrical failures, tried to fire a missile, and had something fired at it. And a nearby jet airliner also suffered radio failure. Now, of course, the naysayers immediately jumped into action. Phil Klass, a world-class debunker, said it's like the pilots in this his own astronomical body. They are so dumb that they misidentified Jupiter as a UFO. According to Klass, the pilot incompetence and equipment malfunction accounted for the reported equipment failures. They're just too dumb to know what they're doing. According to Klass, the Westinghouse technician at Shawrukh Air Base stated only the first F-4 reported failing equipment. This F-4 was known for its equipment failures with a long history of electrical outages, and it underwent a major renovation only a month before the incident. Regarding one pilot's reported bright objects that came at him and that shot straight down to the ground, American skeptic author Brian Dunning observed on that particular day, was a period of time when there were two annual meteorite showers, the Gamma Placids and the Southern Placids, and the tail of the Eta Draconian shower, so observation of falling objects or odd lights wouldn't have been unusual. I wonder if they were standing outside and there was an actual UFO invasion, would they explain that away as something mundane? At the site where the falling light supposedly crashed, a beeping transponder from a C-141 aircraft was supposed to have been found. Now, if we look at all the story's elements without the presumption of an alien spacecraft, the only thing unusual about this event is the planes were chasing celestial objects, not equipment failures. According to the debunkers, Klass and Dunning, ufologists and UFO-themed television programs like Sightings, which describe all the events related to the incident, start with a preconceived motive. UFOs are extraterrestrial. But the debunkers start with a preconceived motive. UFOs can be explained. Let's go to November 5th, 1976, Grenoble, France. A woman and her father in Reeves near Grenoble saw a bright light zooming across the sky at high speed. A physicist driving 7 miles away near Viripo saw the same light, brighter than the moon, at 8:10 p.m. It was a slightly flattened spear shape, white in the center and bluish on the periphery. Object suddenly stopped, hovered for about 3 seconds, and zoomed off in a different direction. A number of other people saw the same object. 3 hours earlier, a similar object was seen 18 miles east of Reeves, and 2 hours later by an air traffic controller at Allnot. Witness near Vienna described the object as flying very fast, being a sixth the size of the moon. The details suggest a speed of 1 mile per second, or about 3,600 miles per hour, which is moving, no matter how you describe it. Jacques Vallée observed that even though the case was remarkable for the convergence and high quality of observation, scientists refused to even look at the data because they said, oh, it's just another UFO report. And UFOs have no place in the rational world. Now, these are supposed to be scientists. So what kind of attitude is that for scientists, that they dismissed independently verified and high-quality data that detail an unexplained and potentially very significant event? It seems it's possible to make absolutely anything ridiculous and insignificant if you attach enough shame and embarrassment to it, and that's exactly what people have done to UFO reports. Let's go to Rendlesham Forest in the UK, December 26, 1980. A number of sightings occurred over 3 days. Strange lights were seen in the sky about 300 meters away. The radio of those who went to investigate failed, and the air felt electrically charged, and an object was said to have landed in the forest. It was reported to be triangular with a strange inscription, as the Keksberg Bell and the Roswell debris had. Very warm to touch and pulsing electrically, and high levels of radioactivity were detected. Now, there's some strange elements to this story, such as an officer feeling compelled to write in binary at the time of the sighting. One witness said he was surprised to find imprints on the ground when inspecting after the object had left because his perception was that it was hovering. Most strangely of all, personnel seemed to be placed at the scene before the UFO arrived and asked to take off their weapons and stand in the forest. And there's an audio recording of one incident where somebody came here asking, "What are we here for?" And somebody else said, "Well, here it comes," right before the object arrived. So was this another radiation exposure experiment or a psychological test or an arranged meeting? The next two nights, lights were seen again. Multiple lights zooming about erratically were reported, and they were seen to send out beams of light toward the ground in several areas. But carefully, they didn't direct those beams toward any people. Well, August 17, 1985, Santiago, Chile. Bright spear was seen and filmed hovering in the sky over Santiago at 2 p.m. Visible for 40 to 50 minutes across half the length of the country. Popular TV show was interrupted for live coverage. January 1985, passengers aboard two aircraft flying over Belarusia observed a strange greenish cloud emitting shafts of bright light that reached down to the ground. Similar sightings on previous occasions had described flashing lights emanating from dark clouds. Now, these type of reports date back to the 1930s when a vast black cloud turned night into day over central Siberia. Then in November 1986, we have what's called the Japan Airlines incident. Captain Kenju Terabuchi, an ex-fighter pilot with 29 years of experience, was flying Japan Airlines Flight 1628, heading for Tokyo. Now, this was a trip like the hundreds he'd flown before, and it was about to take a turn. What was supposed to be a routine journey became a flight he'll never forget. Heading for a refueling stop in Anchorage, Alaska, he spotted three fast-moving objects flying below him. The largest of these objects vaguely resembled a shelled walnut, but the striking thing about the object wasn't its shape, it was its size. According to Rucci, it was roughly the size of two American aircraft carriers. Then he realized the objects were matching his speed. He radioed down to air traffic control and requested a change of course because he didn't want to fly alongside a giant space walnut. Well, his request for a change of course was granted, and shortly after, the ATC in Anchorage grew concerned when connections were severed. It was a cargo flight, so there were no passengers at risk, but the safety of the three-man crew had Anchorage worried. Imagine being told a UFO is following a plane before you lose contact with that plane. Now, what would you think if you looked at the radar and you saw the UFO? Tower and Anchorage didn't have to imagine because that's exactly what happened. After a few minutes, the plane landed safely for refueling and all three crew members were thankfully unharmed. But the pilot had a very interesting story to tell. He said that thing was flying as if there were no such thing as gravity. It sped up, it stopped, it flew at our speed in our direction so that to us it appeared to be standing still. Next instant, it changed course. In other words, this flying object overcame gravity. Well, of course, our resident debunker said he's crazy. But if he's the only one on board who's seeing this, and that would be bad enough, as he's the one that's flying the plane, and okay. But of course, he wasn't the only one seeing it. All three crew members aboard the cargo flight saw something bizarre. Co-pilot also reported the object he saw wasn't a light. It was solid, as real as looking in another plane. So did everybody see the walnut? Well, when they contacted Anchorage ATC to request a change in the flight path, ATC asking everybody plane to get a visual and see what the hell was going on. The plane they asked to check it out only reported seeing Flight 1628. And in turning to change direction and avoid collision with the smaller objects, the giant walnut craft wasn't visible to First Officer Tamafuji. Now, the cargo was Beaujolais, so was Terabuchi sampling the cargo? Well, maybe not. During the incident, Anchorage got a frantic message from Elmendorf Air Force Base because they had spotted the object on the radar at their base as well. Well, an FAA investigation followed these reports. Division Chief John Callahan played back the radar data and synced it with the audio from ATC. And a day later at FAA headquarters, Callahan briefed Donald Ingen. Well, Ingen told him to keep his mouth shut and set up a briefing for the following day. In attendance at the meeting were members of the FBI, the CIA, and President Reagan's scientific study team. Well, after thoroughly reviewing all the evidence, the FBI and the CIA looked superior and said the whole thing was bull and walked out. After the video was finished, everybody in the room was sworn to secrecy, and various entities took all the data and files and videos that Callahan had assembled. Well, just because a pilot may have a lot of experience, that doesn't mean he can't misidentify something. And false radar hits happen all the time, from flocks of birds to weather phenomena. But in this particular instance, we've got a seasoned pilot with only over 29 years of experience, his crew, and not one but two ground-based radar readings, all saying they saw something in the skies over Alaska. And keep in mind that when a pilot reports seeing something bizarre, he's opening himself up for a lot of flack. Pilots are actively dissuaded from reporting any airborne anomalies they encounter. In fact, immediately after the incident, Terucci himself was given a desk job and wasn't allowed to fly for 2 years. So maybe that was the reason the other plane said they didn't see anything. By reporting it, Terucci wasn't just putting his reputation on the line, he was risking his career. So why would somebody do that for 15 minutes of fame? Well, after Callahan had the meeting in Washington and the FBI and the CIA took all his data and told him to shut up, they messed up. They thought he brought everything with him to that meeting, but he didn't. He still had evidence at his office. They had just asked for everything he had with him, so he gave it to him. Seeing the monumental scale of what he was witnessing, Callahan recorded his video of the radar from Elmendorf, and that video is still available. You can find it online. Well, these discoveries are considered very controversial by some scientists. There's a real credentialed scientist by the name of Hoover with over 300 scientific conference proceedings and peer-reviewed papers and over 35 books. He has 23 U.S. international patents and a recognized world authority on diatoms and microbial extremophiles, organisms that can survive in deep crustal rocks and the deepest ocean trenches. In short, he's fairly competent. Worked for NASA at the Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville, Alabama. In fact, he headed the NASA Marshall Space Flight Center astrobiology program from 1997 to 2011. He was awarded the NASA Inventor of the Year in 1992 and retired from NASA December 31st, 2011. He had served almost 50 years with the agency. Well, according to this scientist, the first evidence for fossilized cyanobacteria and other microbes was found in the Orgul Nivana Ci-1 carbonaceous meteorites by Nagy, Claus, and Palik in 1962. These results were dismissed as resulting either from pollen contamination or results of an intentional hoax. But according to Hoover, who followed the debate closely and was skeptical of the contamination claims because the fossils had been found embedded in the rock's matrix, and he discussed his early work with diatoms with friends and scientists such as Sir Robert Ross and Fred Hoyle and Sam Van Landingham, who conducted and confirmed these results in their independent studies. Well, basically, according to the end result, microbial life must be widely distributed in the universe. However, the subject for evidence for extraterrestrial life is considered controversial by NASA. In fact, there's evidence that NASA has not flown a single so-called single life detection experiment to Mars since the Viking missions in 1976. And in fact, the McKay data on possible microfossils in the Mars meteorite AL84001 that triggered the modern astrobiology program was subsequently criticized at NASA We're the only ones here, folks. Get that through your head. And some of the scientists were informed that officials at the White House were worried that a report on extraterrestrial life might be offensive to some of the fundamentalist church in the U.S. and possibly other religions. According to Professor Hoover, NASA has a timetable for releasing information about water on Mars and the possibility of extraterrestrial life. As evidence of this, he showed the audience pictures of snow on Mars taken by NASA Viking landers. And all this was a spectacular color image taken by Viking in 1979. NASA didn't release the pictures until 1997. It was released in 1997 in a NASA poster entitled Postcards from Mars. Well, it was also on the communications console at NASA Johnson Space Center in 1973 when Skylab astronauts Olin Garrett reported to the capsule commander that they were observing red lights outside the Skylab war room window. They were taking photos of this object that appeared to be in orbit with Skylab. Well, the bottom line is, whenever this information is brought up, no matter what it is, if it tends to support the premise that there is other life besides ourselves, it is attacked. It is discredited. It is debunked. And when that doesn't work, they attack the scientist. With the Skylab sightings, they were told that the lights seen in orbit with them were reflections on the window. However, NORAD tracked those lights on the window. Well, there's a number of stories about actual encounters between ETs and the Air Force. If you've been in the military, as I have, you meet people who tell you things like this. Quite often, they even have photographs to back it up. But the military itself poo-poos it. It can't happen. It's your imagination. Well, part of the problem is the powers that be do not want to admit, just like with Roswell, that there are things flying around out there that we can't control in our own airspace. And then, of course, things get confused when you have people like the unbelievably brilliant Don Smith, who takes charge of an event for his own benefit. And stops anybody else from talking who might have a different opinion. Well, on that note, we come to the end of tonight's show. We'll be back tomorrow, and once again, you'll be listening to Ken Hudnall and the Ken Hudnall Show. Till then, have a truly great evening. Bye-bye.